involves anything like analysis of camera video or audio or technologies like predictive policing, which use historical data to try to predict when and where crimes will be happening in the future. And when we heard that AI was being applied to something like police reports, which are really a foundational document in a police investigation and really the strongest record that we have of what happened on the scene in a lot of cases, we were really concerned about the ways that AI's many flaws, like its tendency to hallucinate events, could affect how justice and due process are being applied to individuals subjected to that version of the police narrative.
Before we delve deeper into draft one, can you give our audience a brief overview of other common AI technologies like license plate readers and face recognition that are already in use by law enforcement?
Absolutely. So the term artificial intelligence has been used to describe a lot of different technologies that sometimes simply involve some type of pattern recognition or machine learning or in
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Today, we're talking to Jody Bechtold, CEO of the Better Institute, a globally recognized expert in gambling addiction and a published author. Jody, great to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. Hello to everyone.
Yeah, so I guess we can start off. How'd you get to where you are today working with gambling addiction?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question. I'm a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work, and I was doing a lot in the substance use space when Pennsylvania had their first round of expanded legalized gambling. And I thought to myself, well, I'll just kind of get some training, see what it's all about. And I took the training and realized how much I loved the information. I really felt a passion and a calling for helping those affected by gambling-related harms. And I have never looked back. I just started with one certification after another, and I just kept going. So when you think about since 2000, about 2007, I have been doing this very passionately and very committed. I'm just pleased to be able to help as many individuals and family members as possible. So I have a business in the South Hills of Pittsburgh, and there's six of us that also work with individuals with gambling issues and gambling-related harms and family. And you know, we're forever busy, which is good that we're there for people. And sad that there's not many people that are starting to really be affected by the gambling related harms. So thank you for having me on to spread the word and help educate people.
Yeah, no, for sure. We wanted to talk about gambling addiction today because I feel like it's definitely not as well covered of a problem in many spaces. And, you know, being on a college campus here at Carnegie Mellon, I don't see it mentioned very much. I'd love for our audience and myself to learn a bit more from someone with a lot of experience like you.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is unfortunate. We see that across all campuses across the country. I can even tell you we see that in other countries. Gambling related harms is like so far behind where we are with acceptance about drug or alcohol issues and substance use disorders. And so it's really kind of unfortunate that we don't, you know, there's a lot more shame, stigma, and that public perception still that we fought so hard in the other addiction spaces to combat, and yet this one still seems to be very hidden.
When watching any sports broadcast today, you can notice there's this palpable increase in the amount of coverage that sports betting gets in today's media. Anytime you watch a game or a newscast, SportsCenter, they're always talking about lines and over-under and everything. And this is something that I don't fully remember seeing in broadcasts as a kid. It's definitely increased. So yeah. What are some of the reasons for that increase?
Yeah. In 2018, the Supreme Court overturned the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act. And what that did was it allowed each state to decide if they wanted to do sports betting, which also meant online. So unfortunately, online is kind of a big umbrella term now because so much gambling happens online, not just sports betting. But it really did allow that. And Pennsylvania was one of the first four states to say, yeah, we want it. We want to do sports betting. And in Pennsylvania and a couple other states, sports betting was legal and available right before the pandemic. And so that was another catalyst of harms I see, is that we made things so available online where, you know, your phone is 5 inches from your face at any given time, as you might think about it. And yet we kind of, opened up the doors and said, here you go, you can sports bet. You might have grown up kind of talking about sports betting, but maybe it was a little bit more of a taboo. Maybe it was done with a bookie, or maybe it was just kind of a family bet. But, you know, this now everybody talks about it as if it's been around for quite some time and it's completely socially acceptable, and that everyone's doing it. So you're seeing it on commercials. You are seeing sports with the line going across the bottom. You're seeing all kinds of different things in a way that we never saw 6 years ago.
People used to bet with bookies. Now, because of the prevalence of online sports betting, now you don't have to call up someone and tell them your bet. You can do it alone on your phone in your room. How has the transition from the bookie system to being legal and something that you can do without talking to someone, how has that affected the nature of gambling addiction for people who are betting on sports?
Sure. Great question. I think there's a couple different ways to look at it. One would be that many individuals would say that they gambled and earned the ability to then place a bet with a bookie. So it was kind of like your first thing that you did was place bets with a bookie. You worked your way up, which also meant you had larger bets, larger wagers, more money at stake, things like that. It had a connotation that if you didn't pay the bookies, you know, physical violence might happen. And that was very true for some people back in the day. Then you have this transition where it starts to become legal. Well, you know, it's just your own money that you're using, but you have to kind of put it forward. Put it into the app or the platform and then gamble with it, which was different than, hey, give me, you know, $2,000 on such and such, where I'm not actually giving you the money yet. I'm hoping I never have to give it to you, to a bookie. So just even the way of placing bets and the transaction of money, how money was deposited or exchanged, is very different. So you move forward with today, and we see all the online and the app gambling sites. People can use their money. The illegal sites, you can also use crypto. There's a couple different things that are happening. But we are now seeing a new wave of bookies on college campuses, where it's oftentimes the juniors and seniors, so upper divisional, are creating their own kind of sports betting and sports book and getting the freshmen and sophomores to get into it. So we've gotten several calls from family saying, my son says he owes someone else on campus, you know, $80,000. So these are not small numbers, right? And it's literally kind of a new wave of bookies on campus that we're seeing across the country.
Wow, I didn't know about that. You know, even me being on a college campus, I hadn't heard of that being a problem. So gambling is a pretty wide umbrella, right? When you talk about gambling, that can be anything from playing blackjack at a casino in Vegas or betting on sports on your phone or even using one of the many slot machines that you see in gas stations and bars around Pittsburgh. Is there a gateway drug effect with certain kinds of betting where it's easier for people to get into and then they end up transitioning to different forms of gambling? Or do you find that people mostly stick to the same form of gambling throughout their addiction?
You know, again, I'm always going to say it depends on the individual because you're going to hear different stories. We're definitely seeing that, you know, the average age of someone gambling, you'd be surprised, the average age is 8. Okay. And that's because you don't realize how normalized it is in the family environment that, you know, maybe the grandparent or the uncle or whatever, even the scratch-offs and lottery tickets at the holiday season, that's all forms of gambling. The second thing we're seeing is, you know, how many generations now grew up playing video games, right? Today's average age of a gamer is 34, which tells you they've been gaming quite a long time. But the world is very different in the gaming world now. There's a lot more what we would call gamblification. And so as you know, you can be as young as 5 playing a video game, you've earned the right to move to the next level. And all of a sudden the game puts a slot machine like mechanism in and you have to pull the handle for no reason before you move to the next level. You've already earned it, but they just put that in there anyways. So it's those little small subtle plays that are getting a young generation to be very comfortable with gambling-like behaviors. And then, you know, we also talk about wagering or gambling for virtual items. And then, you know, the most popular is the loot boxes, trying to get certain skins, right? So there's a lot of gambling that goes on in video games that people don't even think about. And so it can be a very natural rite of passage as I become of legal age or close to legal age and I have access to gambling. I feel very comfortable doing it because of the world I just came from.
I was just going to bring that up, actually. You predicted my next question, because when I was in middle school, I played a game called Counter-Strike Global Offensive, better known as CSGO. And that game has a very strong, huge betting market, essentially, on opening these cases for skins. And so growing up, I personally saw a lot of my favorite YouTubers, all of their videos would just be them spinning a wheel to get a skin. And it literally has the ticker going across the screen. It looks like a slot machine.
That's right.
So yeah, that must be priming in some respect, young kids to eventually get into gambling.
Well, and it gets people comfortable. I think that's the key. They feel very, you know, just like the, so much of the gambling is on a smartphone. People are very comfortable with the technology. And so it's much easier to try it out because they're so comfortable with technology.
Yeah. In terms of treatment of gambling addiction, which is what you do, what are some of the strategies that people use to treat gambling addiction on a personal level?
So there's a couple different things. I like to help people focus on 3 areas. How do you spend your time? How do we limit or shut off access to gambling? And how do we limit or shut off access to money? Those 3 focus areas will really help somebody stop gambling, whether they want to do it short term or not, or at least reduce the ability to get into trouble. Then once you have that kind of in place, kind of shutting off access to gambling, things like suspension in the app or a cool off for 30 days or state self-exclusion, exclude me from all the apps in the state, right? When you don't have any access to gambling, then we work on access to money because obviously you could still place a bet with a bookie or do something illegal, right? That really helps people kind of, you know, quiet all the chaos. And then we're able to really understand on an individual level what else is happening for that individual. Some people might have undiagnosed and undertreated depression or anxiety or ADHD is a very common one. Other people might be going through a very traumatic time in their life. They might have experienced some difficulties and they don't know how to deal with it. And so they kind of avoid or escape by gambling. In treatment, we really want to treat the whole person and really help that person. And it's really evolved over probably, I would say, the last 6 years since we legalized it in Pennsylvania. We're getting a lot more younger people. Before, it used to be much older, chronic, you know, lots of rounds of saying I'll stop and then they don't. Now we're getting a much younger age. The research is also very compelling. The average age now of a sports bettor getting help is 26. Oof. Tends to be very educated, has a very good job, and has lots of disposable income. Right. So lots of disposable income. Boy, we wish we all had that problem. But it's really because they have a good job, because they're educated, but they don't have all the major financial responsibilities yet. They don't own a house yet. You know, maybe their parents are still keeping them on the cell phone plan because it's the family plan, right? And it just feels like a lot more money post-graduation, and they don't have any accountability for where that money needs to go. And they're also used to gambling. And so it's an easy way for people to spend their money. So we're getting a lot more younger people that have gambled away tremendous amounts of money. And it's very unfortunate. It's almost avoidable in some ways. The other piece that we're seeing is it's a younger generation that's being affected, which also means that maybe their brain's not fully developed yet. The prefrontal cortex of the brain for good judgment and impulsivity isn't fully developed until 25. We're seeing higher suicide rates. And I would say with gambling disorders, it's one of the highest suicide rates of all addictive disorders. And that's something else the public really doesn't know and rarely talks about. And so I always want to make sure when I get to do opportunities to speak like this, that we do talk about suicide. Because people, since they're not ingesting a chemical first, you can't see their eyes are glassy. They're not slurring their speech, anything like that. You don't know how much their gambling might be, causing devastation. They might look really well put together on the outside when they're absolutely crumbling on the inside. And so it's really important anytime we talk about problem gambling that we also take into mind and take into account this, the higher suicide rate that goes along with that.
You spoke about some of the at-risk demographics with respect to gambling. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Who's susceptible to the problem gambling in today's day and age?
Yeah. So because gambling across the country, I mean, we went from two states that had legalized sports betting. We're now at 38 states and counting in a very short amount of time. Unfortunately, the gambling has become more widespread than the research. The research hasn't been able to catch up yet. So some of the earlier research is definitely pointing to a younger age. Male is much more susceptible, especially to sports betting. That doesn't mean that women are not gambling or getting into trouble. It's just that the males are definitely more susceptible. And we're definitely seeing what we would call co-occurring depression, anxiety, absolutely attention deficit disorder, ADHD is what we would refer to it. That is definitely one that is a vulnerability for anything addictive, just because it's hitting the same part of the brain. I'm trying to keep it in layman's terms, but the brain can be very vulnerable for some individuals. It could be, you know, genetic vulnerability, and it can just be environmental, what they've seen growing up, not realizing that gambling can cause harms or gambling can become a problem because they just kind of grew up with it and feel it's just completely normalized around them. So the research is still very slow to tell us what to look for, who to pay attention to. Some research coming out of the gambling industry, we could say, is targeting more minorities, and individuals, because they're targeting them with different free play incentives and making them feel like there's a quick way to win money, which really is not quick. So there's a lot to be said for it. It's unfortunate we just don't know enough yet.
So it seems like the deregulation of gambling and the fact that it got unbanned in many states has been a catalyst for an increase in the amount of problem gambling. Is that a Pandora's box that we can't put back in? Or are there regulatory measures we can take to help stem the problem societally?
Well, we live in a country that has 50 states, so there's going to be 50 different ways to do things. What we are seeing, for example, is take a state that legalizes marijuana, cannabis, and they legalize gambling. And sports betting is the most recent one. The regulations are so long in terms of what the state has to do, what the dispensaries have to follow in order to do any type of cannabis. The regulations compared to for sports betting and online is very short. So we have fallen behind in consumer protection relative to the rate of expansion and making, you know, gambling accessible, again, 5 inches from your face. So we have a lot of work to do. There's a lot of people, a lot of organizations that are trying to speak about this, generate more awareness. But what most people don't realize is there's no federal oversight for gambling, the way there's federal oversight for mental health and substance use. So we have, you know, NIMH, we have SAMHSA, we have nothing for gambling. So there's no like gold standard. There's no playbook that every state has to take from. Every state gets to decide to do whatever they want. And unfortunately, I will say currently in Pennsylvania, we're falling very far behind in consumer protection. We're almost going the other direction with regulatory rules and things like that, that are really not protecting the individual anymore. So it's definitely in an uphill battle. I hate to be such a Debbie Downer about it, but this is real life stuff. We don't have federal oversight. We don't have federal funding. So we don't have federal research, all of these things. We don't have federal money dedicated to treatment, right? To prevention, any of that stuff. So we have a long way to go.
Do you see any movement coming in that in the next coming years? Do you think it'll get better soon or?
I sure hope so. I really do. I mean, there are some groups out there, a lot of advocacy groups. I think when the research is released and it's showing how much harm we're causing, I know that parents are getting really fed up. You know, it's just how loud of a voice can we have at a federal level is really the issue. There is a bill that is trying to be pushed through Congress and Senate. But we know how that is at the time of an election. That usually doesn't go anywhere.
So circling back to what I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, that I see gambling advertisements everywhere on TV, what are some of the impacts of the marketing tactics used by gambling companies and yeah, sports bettors? Specifically, customized free play deals. I read something about how like problem gamblers are targeted by the apps with the deals to reel them back in.
Yeah.
How does that affect the landscape of problem gambling?
Well, I can't say that I know firsthand because I don't work for the gambling industry. So I don't know kind of inside what they do. But what we do know are a couple different things. We know that free play is never free. Right. And that most individuals, if you ask them when they download an app, do they read the terms and agree the terms when they download an app, or do they just quickly hit I agree? So free play is a little bit like that. What do I have to do to get this free play? I've had clients tell me I chased $1,000 of free play, but the fine print said I had to gamble 14 times that amount in a 9-day period in order to get my money. Now, I don't know if that's 100% true, but just let's take 50% of it, right? If you're trying to get $1,000 free, you had to gamble 14,000 of your own money to get 1,000. And you had to do it in a very short amount of time. Is that really free? Right. And that's the fine print that a lot of individuals, when I'm working with them, they said, I was in a trance. I was kind of hooked. Of course, I wasn't reading the fine print, didn't notice anything about it. I've also had people say they tried to stop gambling for a while and they were given a phone call or an email from someone within the platform saying, I noticed you haven't been gambling in a while. I just put $1,000 on your account.
Wow.
Okay, so to me, I would use the word predatory, right? It's unfortunate. Now, with all the technology out there, with all the algorithms and everything we know about AI, it's much easier to detect when someone might be problematic in their betting. But what does the industry, the companies do about it? Well, there's no regulations to tell them what to do about it. So you can talk to five different industry, you know, gambling companies and hear five different ways that they say that they don't want problem gamblers. But what we don't really know for sure, it's kind of all happens in a box that we don't know about.
Yeah. All you really see is the little text at the bottom, which is like call 1-800-GAMBLER.
And that is a regulation. In Pennsylvania, 1-800-GAMBLER has to be shown at a certain font size, relative to the other font size of any promotional things. You'll see that pretty much in the brick and mortar casinos. Where it gets lost is in the online space, because it's in the inside the app, and it's like, no, we have it in our app, but where is it in the app? Right? It's not scrolling along the bottom of the screen of the phone the whole time. So it's even less prominent to see that 1-800 gambler number.
One thing that you mentioned earlier is that it's trickier for people to understand gambling addiction because it's not a substance. It's not like smoking or drinking, where there's something physically being ingested by people and they're addicted. Can you talk a little bit more to the brain chemistry of gambling addiction and how it actually is similar to those kinds of addictions, even if it's not a physical substance? Yeah. Like, what makes gambling so addictive?
Yeah. Well, the psychology of the game is one, you know, how it's designed, just like certain, you know, video games are designed to be have a little bit more stickiness or a hook to them. So we definitely know certain ways that games are created will really grab people. It hits the dopaminergic system of the brain. And, you know, we talk about almost like a lab rat, you know, banging that lever to get as much dopamine as possible. When you can place bets constantly, like it's no longer at the beginning of the game, what is your bet for the outcome of the game? It's every single thing that happens. What's the coin toss? Which coach is going to get Gatorade poured on them? I mean, you name it, it's called in-game betting. Think about how quickly you can just keep betting and saying, okay, I lost that one. I got to bet again to try and recover my losses. All of that's hitting the dopaminergic system, to the point where it's just a dopamine high that someone cannot mimic any other way. But then there's also the crash, right? And so then you chase that dopamine hit, that rush again, just like people would chase drugs, just like they would chase getting high, right? So it actually hits the exact same part of the brain without ingesting the chemical first. And that's what also makes it so similar to other addictive disorders, but also what we would call a hidden addiction, because you just can't see it. You can't smell it. You know, they're not driving funny. They're not walking funny. How do they pass out, right? Too much alcohol, you pass out. Too many drugs, you pass out or overdose. How do you pass out from too much gambling? You run out of money or sheer exhaustion. So you can cause a lot more damage in a shorter amount of time.
In terms of the damage caused by gambling addiction, on the person itself, clearly there's financial damage and also mental damage. How about on the people around them? What are some of the negative impacts of gambling addiction on family members or people in their community, as well as the negative impacts of gambling addiction on society as a whole? What's the societal cost of all of this problem gambling?
Well, we don't have any federal research to be able to answer that question. I would love to be able to answer that. We can take from other countries and kind of say this is maybe the direction we're headed. Related to gambling-related harms and suicide out of the UK, they're saying for every individual that dies by suicide, 135 people were affected. That's a large number. So we think about gambling here. When someone is experiencing gambling-related harms, we absolutely know at minimum the family is affected, the friend group is affected, and possibly, you know, maybe some coworkers or work-related individuals or even employment opportunities could be affected. The financial devastation is absolutely number one for many people. That's what gets everybody's attention. That's what people measure almost in terms of severity sometimes. The mental, absolutely mental health related issues. Many, many people are so depressed because of that dopamine crash, as well as the shame and the embarrassment of what has happened. And they think that there's something morally wrong with them because they were supposed to be able to stop or control it. And that's a myth, right? The brain is hijacked just like it is with chemicals, and people can't control. It's almost like they never took care of the brakes on their car, so they don't have brakes when they're ready to stop, right? So it just keeps going. So there's many areas that are affected to a lesser or greater degree. It just depends on the individual, how long they've been gambling, how compulsively they've been gambling, and what access to funds do they have. Ultimately, we really want to help people before it gets too severe, because for many, they will commit crimes at some point to continue to gamble. They don't mean to commit crimes. They're quote, borrowing from someone when really they're stealing from someone. We call it gambling motivated crime because they're completely motivated to do something or cross the line just to keep gambling in hopes that they will win and recover all their losses, which never happens, and they just keep getting further and further in the hole.
Yeah, it seems pretty dire. This is a pretty big problem in America today. To wrap us up for the episode, is there anything that us regular people can do to help combat the problem?
Yeah, I love when people ask me that question when I'm interviewed. Have the conversation is what I will tell everyone. You know, talk to your friends, talk to your siblings, like openly talk about gambling. Don't make it a taboo conversation, and literally feel confident enough if you see a friend or a loved one that you really believe is gambling more at risk or very risky, say something. You don't know how much they might be crumbling on the inside, and they're just waiting for at least one person to say, I'm here for you. Let's get help together. What do you need? So have the conversation is the best way to break the stigma and end the silence.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for joining us today on Forbes Avenue, Jody. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM with Jody Bechtold, the CEO of the Better Institute and a globally recognized expert in gambling addiction. Thanks for listening.
I need to pay bills. When is my tax refund coming?
I need to pay my taxes. What are my payment options?
I need to set up a payment plan. How do I do that?
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
I need help with my taxes. Does the IRS offer free help?
I need a tax preparer. How should I choose one?
Need answers to your tax questions? Go to irs.gov.
Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
Look at the various gatherings, the big gathering they had at Carnegie Hall for the 75th birthday of Paul Robeson. And you'll find the Harry Belafonte's, all of the towering artists who knew that they owed a tremendous debt to Paul Robeson. It's very interesting at that gathering. One of those powerful words were said by Coretta Scott King at that gathering. She was still mourning the death of Martin. And she said, America did to Paul Robeson what I think they ended up doing to Martin. They buried him alive. See, Coretta's hitting on something deep. Inexcusable treatment of a person who had the courage to tell America about itself in regard to its injustices. They bury him alive.
That's Cornel West, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Cornel West on the legacy of Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson is one of the 20th century's most enduring and multi-talented figures. He broke through the color line and excelled in sports, film, music, and theater. He became world famous, yet in the United States, he was to be persecuted and hounded for his political beliefs. In his recordings, particularly of spirituals and folk songs, Robeson's mellifluous bass baritone voice awakened African Americans to their heritage and gained him a broad audience. He won acclaim on Broadway, especially in the musical Showboat, in which he sang the classic Old Man River. His dramatic performance in Othello is legendary. By the 1930s, he was singing in major concert halls all over the United States and Europe. By the early 1940s, one biographer states that Robeson was the most famous black man in America. Theodore Dreiser, the well-known writer of the day, hailed Robeson as an artistic and social genius. Never content to be just an entertainer, Robeson had strong political views, and he wasn't afraid to express them. He condemned racism and segregation in the United States. He was an anti-imperialist who advocated the liberation of Africa and Asia from their European colonial masters. He was an early and vociferous opponent of fascism. He visited Spain and sang for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, who were fighting Franco. He admired the Soviet Union and said so openly. After World War II, the U.S. was saturated in the ideology of anti-communism. The Soviet Union, erstwhile ally, was now the arch enemy. Robeson's support for the USSR did not waver, and for it, he paid a heavy personal and professional price. He was a target of Hoover's FBI. He was verbally and physically assaulted and attacked. One notorious incident occurred in 1949 in Peekskill, New York. Robeson would later recall the baying of the lynch mob, the cries for my life from the hate-twisted mouths. In 1950, the State Department revoked his passport, declaring that Paul Robeson's travel abroad would be contrary to the best interests of the United States. Here is Robeson in his own words.
And why do they take my passport away? They have said so in a case. They put it in a brief. They said that no matter what my political beliefs, what my standing among the Negro people of my own land in America, but they would have to take my passport away anyhow, because out of my own lips, mind you, from my own lips, for many years, I have been struggling for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa. And that is meddling in the foreign affairs of the United States government. Now, that's just too bad, because I'm going to have to continue to meddle.
Having his passport taken away was a tremendous blow to Robeson's career. He was not only unable to perform overseas, but he was blacklisted domestically. His income plummeted. The return of his passport in 1958 came too late. His final years were marked by depression and illness. He died in 1976 in relative obscurity. In recent years, because of important biographies by Martin Duberman and Lloyd Brown, as well as the work and efforts of others, there's a revival of interest in Paul Robeson. One can hardly imagine a better person to talk about Robeson's legacy than Cornel West. He's been called the preeminent African-American intellectual of his generation. He's the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Professor of Philosophy at Union Theological Seminary. With his preacher-like cadences and passionate delivery, he's much in demand as a speaker. A prolific author, his book Race Matters was a bestseller. He ran for president as an independent in 2024. Cornel West gave the first annual Paul Robeson lecture at Columbia University Law School. This classic from the AR archives, marking Black History Month, was recorded in February 1999. And now, Cornel West.
I must say, I tremble as I rise and lift my voice to put forward reflections on Paul Leroy Robeson. There's levels suffering, sacrifice, sadness, loneliness, courage that constitutes such a formidable challenge for us to dwell into the complexity of his life. I congratulate Columbia Law School for having the audacity to begin a lecture series in the name of the great Paul Leroy Robeson. Now, I know he's class 1923. He wasn't too crazy about the place, we should say. He had very, very pleasant memories of the dean at that time, Harlan Fisk Stone. He had classmates like Thomas Dewey and William O. Douglas. But he zipped through. He didn't practice law for too long, just a few months after being hired by a firm, Stonesbury and Minor firm. And after working on the will of Jay Gould, he was just a stenographer who said, "I'll never take dictation from a nigger." And he decided maybe he ought to do something else with his life. Never took the bar. But in the best of the Columbia Law School tradition, his mind was sharpened. But as is true in most law schools, one wonders whether the mind is not only sharpened, but also, in many ways, narrowed. Can you sharpen your mind and at the same time broaden it, refine it, so that you have a sense of the whole rather than zero in the specialized, professionalized, routinized way in which so much of legal studies is often done? But you have no sense of what the larger calling actually is as public servant or as analyst for various firms who themselves have a collective and public responsibility. Paul Robeson, for me, terrifying. I've never had the gumption to speak publicly about Paul Robeson because he scares me. And you can bet your bottom dollar this is going to be the last lecture I give on Paul Robeson in a long time. Because it takes too much out of me. Well, let's begin where he would want us to begin, by situating him in a story bigger than himself, situating him in a set of narratives larger than himself, understanding Paul Robeson as a small part of a great, long, rich tradition of struggle. Going back to Robeson Plantation, Crossroads, Martin County, North Carolina, his father, William Drew Robeson, born a slave. Escapes at the age of 15. Makes his way to Pennsylvania. Engages in farm labor to pay his way through Lincoln University. His father, an extraordinary person, himself part of a larger backdrop, a wave in an ocean of those who came before, of many thousands gone. Obtains his A.B. at Lincoln University, his ministerial degree at Lincoln University, and makes his way to Princeton after meeting his lovely wife, Maria Louise Bustillo, herself lineage of a grand tradition, grandfather from Sephardic Jews, who encountered black folk in the New World, producing children like all of us, culturally hybrid. You see. And Princeton, of course, the very site where Paul Robeson was born, in his own words, spiritually located in Dixie, but geographically located in New Jersey. I happen to be a very proud holder of a Princeton degree, so I won't push this too far. But we know that Princeton was the only acceptable school for Southern elites. No accident, the first black went to Princeton in 1947, Harvard 1872, Columbia, you tell me. Princeton's always been behind when it comes to taking seriously the vicious legacy of white supremacy. Trying to catch up lately. God help him. Made some strides lately. But Paul Robeson was born in a Jim Crow context. His father was pastor with the Spoon Street Presbyterian Church for over 20 years, but was pushed out because he was an outspoken critic of the Jim Crow situation in Princeton. Paul Robeson never forgot it. Paul Robeson had to leave Princeton when the father was pushed out. His mother died very tragically when he was six. She was brilliant. She wrote some of her husband's sermons, which is not typical in the black church. He moved a number of times in New Jersey, ended up in Somerville. His father had to change denominational affiliation to AME Zion because he couldn't deal with the deep racism in the Presbyterian Church. And for many years, Paul Robeson lived alone with his father, the two of them. His father was 53 when he was born, an older man. Paul Robeson was a baby. Seven children, five survived. Paul Robeson had, in many ways, I'm saying, unbelievable privilege given the status of black folk at the time. A deep belief in himself, in his talents, in his capabilities. He thought about going to Princeton, decided to go to Rutgers, though his father wanted him to go to Lincoln. And of course, the record at Rutgers is unbelievable. All American. Phi Beta Kappa in his junior year. Winner of the oratorical contest all 4 years, freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, senior year. First time Rutgers football team ever beat Princeton in the history of the game. You can imagine the smile that put on Brother Paul's face. And yet, as you can imagine, many schools like William and Mary and Georgia Tech refusing to play Rutgers as long as Paul was on the field. Graduates 1919. And then on to New York. Thinking about theater. Wrestling with the call of theater versus the call of law.
and actually went through Columbia Law School while, in fact, he was an actor. I don't know how many of you are attempting that. It's a difficult thing to do, and it's not just a matter of learning lines in one context and memorizing cases in the other. But he pulled it off. And during the time here at Columbia, he met the love of his life, his Landa Cardozo, good essay, herself Columbia grad. God bless you. Class of 1917 obtained the first position of a black person on staff at Presbyterian Hospital. Paul Robeson met her as patient in hospital with Essie as one administering to him. Long marriage, but we're talking about buffers, what he could fall back on. Why? Because we know in his life, from 1898 to 1976, he would need tremendous buffers in order to deal with the chilly whirlwinds, not just of white supremacy, but of Cold War, marginalization by mainstream black America, misunderstood, misconstrued, traveling around the world, doing what? Trying to keep alive this tradition of struggle. Always viewing himself as but one person to whom the baton had been handed to, and knowing he would have to hand that baton off to those who would come after. Paul Robeson, in many ways, reflects the plight and predicament of so many Americans, especially black Americans, who had attempted to do the same thing. Think of Frederick Douglass in 1893, 2 years before he dies. No blacks allowed the World Exposition in Chicago, but he, being a representative of the State Department in Haiti, is able to attend as a Haitian, but not as a black American, wrestling with a despair at the end of his life. Think of T. Thomas Fortune, that grand journalistic crusader, who dies all by himself in an old dilapidated hotel in Trenton, New Jersey. Think of Zora Neale Hurston, working for white mothers as a maid after writing such literary texts. Her eyes are watching God, dying all alone. No tomb for the body. Think of Marcus Garvey by himself, London, Jamaica, late convert, Roman Catholicism, nearly forgotten. Think of Martin King's last years, the years that we would rather not think about. Where he's saying over and over again, America is so much sicker than I thought. White supremacy saturates and permeates every nook and cranny. I thought I had victory. Is it relatively hollow as a Pyrrhic? Think of W.B. Du Bois. 1961. Joins the Communist Party at the age of 93. Leaves 2 days later and says, I spent my whole life trying to create a multiracial democracy. I cannot conceive of the masses of black people being treated decently and kindly and equally owing to the racist tilt of most of my fellow citizens of European descent, even given the heroic efforts of the well-intended ones. Take me to Ghana and don't ever bury one molecule of my body in America. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about a Paul Robeson, not because he's perfect or pure or pristine, but because he had the courage to look himself, America, and the world in the face and say, I want to attempt to tell the truth about it. And anytime one attempts to show the ways in which our will to truth is untruthful about itself,
the way in which the American will to truth is often untruthful about itself. You're gonna suffer. We know about Paul Robeson's two suicide attempts, 1961. The wrist, 65, the scissors. The loving care of Paul Jr., unbelievably loving care of Paul Jr. and his wife, Marilyn Rosenberg Robeson, to keep Paul going during those 11 years of darkness, reminding one of the last years of Nietzsche and Hurdling and others. Not madness, but on the brink. What a price to pay, given the fact that in 1944 and 1945, he was the loving Paul Robeson. Americans crazy about him, receiving awards from every major institution. Why? Because he was supporting the war effort. But so quickly it changes when you try to be a truth teller about America. Think of Muhammad Ali, truth teller, demonized. And after the progressive leaders and the black leaders are nearly dead, the political movements they represent, relatively dormant, they're then resurrected. King the same way every January. Now he's a hero. Now Robeson, oftentimes affirmed, appreciated. But not just his body dead and gone, but what he represented more and more feeble in our society. Where are the truth?
I need to pay bills. When is my tax refund coming?
I need to pay my taxes. What are my payment options?
I need to set up a payment plan. How do I do that?
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
I need help with my taxes. Does the IRS offer free help?
I need a tax